Our scripture reading today continues the Sermon on the Mount. Today is Matthew 5. We're starting at verse 27 to 30. You have heard that it was said, "You shall not commit adultery." But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. God's word.
All right. Yay, us. Cutting off arms and gouging out eyes. I don't have enough coffee in here for this sermon. Okay, if you are brand new to this church, welcome. My name is Grant. I probably should have said that before. Everybody gets to see my password. And I'm the pastor here. It's good that you're here. I'm glad that you're here. If you're brand new to church, okay, just give me 20 minutes. Because this is one of those passages that you already go, see, this is why. Christians are weird. The church sucks. Like, they're talking about sex. I don't like talking about sex. And, you know, I'm not going to, you can't tell me what to do anyways. Which would be most of our, like, typical normal approaches to topics that we don't, you know, that are typically private. And then to boot, you're going to tell me to gouge out my eye and cut off my arm like I knew it. Christians are weird. I'm out. So I will let you know, there are doors back there. They're open. They're unlocked. You can escape. It's possible. Man, there are some passages, in the Bible, I've said this before, that I just wish were not there. And these are some of them, because I'm like, this makes us look weird as Christians. And so we're going to go after it. Two major sections here, the piece on adultery and then the piece on gouging out our eyes. I'm just going to say this now. I like my philosophy for ministry, and like kind of this is the bar for me. This is like, at the end of the day, what do I want? I would love for what we do on Sunday morning, like not just the preaching, okay? This is only a part of it. But the music and being together and prayer and preaching, reading the Bible, like all of it. For me, the goal is that what we do here on Sunday changes the way you live on Monday. And I'm just going to say, in case you do decide to leave, the goal is not for you to cut off your arm and gouge out your eye, okay? So let's just leave it at that. Like, the sermon over, okay? Just don't go do that. But we are going to talk about what I think Jesus is talking about, why it is still significant to us. I'm going to pray, because when we hit verses like this, that's all I know how to do. Let me pray. God, thanks that you love us. Thanks that you're with us. Thanks even for really bizarre passages like this. I do pray that you would teach us and challenge us. There may be some people here who need to hear a specific word, and so, God, would you allow them to hear it this day? I pray that we wouldn't hear anything too weird. But, you know, we trust, God, that you're actually in this. That, for me, at the end of the day, is what matters. That you're here, you're speaking, you're moving, and you want to teach us. So would you do that? In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so we are in the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is, like we've discussed, I'm just going to do a really quick recap because it's been a couple weeks. We took a break last week for our Vision Sunday, our annual meeting. Many of you were here for that. Sermon on the Mount, a little bit of a misnomer. The Mount probably wasn't even as big as the escarpment is in Hamilton, which is not even as big as some of the mountains, like my wife, you know, knows from the West Coast. Sermon on a rolling hill. But the basic idea, right, as we've discussed, is Jesus has his followers called disciples. He takes his disciples a little ways away, up the mountain, up a hill, to teach them. It's teaching that is directed at people who would claim to be followers of Jesus, and then it's a few chapters long, and what we see over the course of the sermon is, or the teaching is, Jesus begins with his followers, and he begins in what would be more of like a conversation type scale, and then it shifts. So people begin to overhear, and the crowds start to hear, and they start to turn their ear, and they kind of start to listen, and they gather. And so our heart is, and what I believe is true about the messages within the Sermon on the Mount, is that for some of you, you may be like lifelong followers of Jesus, and like you've been on the rock here like 90 plus years, and you've been following Jesus 90 plus years, and you've, you know, nobody reaches expert level, but you know, you've been around the block a few times. And some people who are here might be, you know, just kind of curious, not quite sure what the church believes, and passages like this may or may not help. I hope this helps. But you're just a little unsure about it. And so maybe find yourself like a crowd member. Other people, maybe you think I'm a little bit nuts for talking about especially passages that sound like this. And so you're not even in the crowd. Like you're just kind of overhearing. And what was true about Jesus' day is that for all of those groups, the Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus taught, had relevant, meaningful impact in their lives. And I think the same thing is still true today. So whether you find yourself a believer, follower of Jesus, whether you find yourself kind of in the crowd, you're not quite sure, but you're asking some questions, or whether you find yourself completely like, this guy's stupid. This guy being me. I think this actually has weight for all of us. And what we've discussed in the Sermon on the Mount, and this is the background that you need to know, I think, for a passage like today, is that what we find is that Jesus is far more concerned about your heart than he is about your actions. And what we looked at, so for example, 2 weeks ago, we discussed the idea of murder. And Jesus says, listen, murder, that's a good thing not to do. We should probably maintain that 10 command, like that, you know, that number of commandments. We should probably still encourage people not to murder each other. But he says, that's not the bar for a meaningful, life-giving follower of Jesus. The bar for us, he says, is actually anger. So he says, murder, great. Probably most people here haven't murdered somebody, but every single person here has been angry. He says, that's a heart issue. God is more concerned about your heart than he is about your actions, what you do. Why is that? Because if you are focused on doing the right thing, life becomes a checklist for you. And it's about doing the right thing today, and crap, I screwed that up, you know, the next day, and then I got this one right, and this one right, and this one right, and you're constantly trying to tip the scale in your favor. Jesus says, listen, actually, the heart is what matters most. Because if you're focusing on the heart and becoming the right person, not doing the right things, you eventually are going to do some right things. So we discussed 2 weeks ago this idea that your actions reveal your heart. Your actions, the things you do, the things we all do, have the tendency to reveal our heart. Connie's not here this morning, so I want to tell you a little bit of a dynamic that exists in our household. Not because Connie's not here. I told her I was going to say this. And the dynamic is this. The dynamic is this. And this is why I think this is important for us, this whole idea of heart and action and getting things squared away early on is important. The dynamic is this. If given to my natural proclivities and, you know, all good desires and intentions, our house will become pretty unorganized, pretty messy, pretty quickly. Okay? This is just the natural state of my universe is not exceptionally clean. How many people are surprised by this? Nobody. This is the reality of my life. Okay? Connie, if given to her natural proclivities and propensity, like, the house will be immaculately organized. Enter a two-year-old, and the whole thing goes to... I don't know a good word to follow that up with in church. It goes south. There we go. Let's put it that way. Let's flip that. If given to my natural proclivities, our car will stay immaculate. But Connie, on the other hand, well, the garbage piles up until she can't get in the car. I'm like, how is this comfortable anymore? You can't even get in. So there's stuff rolling around. It's like, I don't understand. She is so exceptionally clean in our house, but the car is a completely different story. It's been that way since long before we were married. This is the reality. And I think the reality for us, and this is why it is so important for us to get at the heart issue of what Jesus is talking about in the Sermon on the Mount, is because for each one of us, there are things, and there may be a thing, as in like the main thing, that your life will tip toward that is dysfunctional and unhealthy if left to your own devices. Each one of us has something in our lives that we have a tendency to do or to tip toward doing when life is stressful, when things aren't going our way, when we're looking for a way out, when we are looking for a little bit of fun or enjoyment or happiness or bliss or just even disconnection, you know, detachment from the reality of what we're going through in life. Each one of us has the thing that we tip toward that the Bible would classify or call sin. That thing that separates us from God. That thing that gets in the way of our relationship with God. So last week we talked, or 2 weeks ago rather, we talked about anger being that root issue. I told you stories about my commutes. Today we're talking about lust. Lust. And again, the act is adultery in this particular case, but the root issue, the heart issue, is lust. It's the idea of lust. Why is it important? Paul names some of the issue for us. And there's a lot going on here. Just listen to this. This is Paul in Romans. He says, I don't understand what I do. I don't get it. It's like, I just don't get it. What I want to do, I do not do. Okay? He's like, I want to do this, but I don't do it. What I hate, I do, for I have the desire to do what is good, but I can't do it, I can't carry it out, for there's too many do's and not do's, and I'm a little dyslexic, like, so, for I do not do the good I want to do, but the evil I do not want to do, this I keep doing. Listen, the basic principle is this: he wants to do what's good, he doesn't do it, he doesn't want to do what's evil, and he keeps doing it. Like, why couldn't the dude have said it a little simpler? But this says, this is fundamental to human beings, that there is something broken within each one of us that tips toward an issue. So into that, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But, so again, you shall not commit adultery. This is one of the commandments. This is something that would have been well known in Jesus' day. You have heard it said. That actually is true. Like, when we read this now, you've heard that it was said. It's like, well, I mean, maybe you've heard that said, but in Jesus' day, everybody would have heard this. Do not commit adultery. Just don't do it. What did that mean in Jesus' day? It means that if you were married, it means no sex outside of that marriage covenant, because things were a little bit different then. A man could have been married to multiple women. And so anyways, it's just sex outside of the marriage covenant. Just leave it at that. That's as simple as a way to understand it. And so he's saying, listen, it's good. This is a good place to start. If you are married, don't have sex outside of marriage. Plain and simple, like, honor your marriage covenant. So some of you are married, some of you are not married, some of you have been married. But basically, listen, what Jesus is saying is, at that act level, what we do does matter. He says, this is a good place to start. Don't have sex outside of your marriage covenant. Honor that vow that you made. Right? For me, when I got married, it was just over 5 years ago, so it's a little bit closer than some of you. I don't mean that in any negative way. I mean in that sense that you have way more experience in life than me, and when things go south in my marriage, I'm going to come knocking on your door and be like, I need some help, man. I said something and Connie's pissed at me. But listen, I can remember standing up there, making that vow to Connie and saying, listen, like, in sickness and in health, and we've experienced some sickness in our lives, for richer or poorer. Let me tell you, we've experienced some of the poorer and some of the richer, just Like, we've experienced that financially and otherwise. In sickness and until death do you part. And I got to tell you that there are some days where that's a pretty hard vow to maintain. Right? There are some days where that honoring that is difficult. And not in the sense that, like, you're just going to go out and sleep with whoever you find. But, like, in the sense that it is difficult to positively enter into that covenant each and every day. It's why I long and hope. And if somebody comes and says, hey, would you marry, you know, me and my partner, I say, yeah, but you got to come to church for 5 weeks in a row. You got to come and meet with me for 5 hours. Like, we're going to spend some time talking about this, because we just need to square some things away. Like, marriage is difficult. Marriage is hard.
Amen.
Yeah. Nobody turn around and look at who said that. But Jesus says, listen, it is a good thing to honor it. And life is going to be the richer and the better for honoring it. So it's a great place to start. Honor this covenant, this thing that you've entered into. And when it's too hard to do that, find some help. Get some people in your life that are going to surround you and that are going to, you know, be a part of that messiness with you. That's just the reality of life. Like, holy. You know, get some people around you who are going to help you with this. But then Jesus goes on. He says, actually, that's not the issue. Right? He says, that's not the issue. The issue isn't just being faithful to something for the sake of being faithful to something. The issue isn't just following the rules, right? Like, the issue isn't just, you know, don't commit adultery because, listen, I'm telling you to, and I want life to be boring. Like, he says, there is a root issue behind the act of adultery. Just like anger was the root issue, the heart issue behind murder, he says, lust is the heart issue behind adultery. And so I'm surely never going to ask anybody to say, listen, who's committed adultery here? Just like I didn't ask you, who's committed murder? But when we start talking about lust, let's just be honest for a second. This is something that almost everyone, and I would actually argue every single person, probably has dealt with in some season of their life. Lust is a heart issue. Lust is something that every single person has to deal with, has to face. He says, that's the root issue behind adultery. That's the heart issue that Jesus wants to come and get at. And in this particular situation, he's saying lust, as in looking at, you know, a man, a woman, I don't think it matters the gender, right? In a way that breaks your marriage covenant. In a way that betrays the promise that you made, that I made to Connie, to be faithful only to her, right? And to find in her only everything that I need. And to be for her everything that she needs. Now, I mean, I fail at that. That's the reality of life too, right? But this is the vow that we try to step into. And Jesus says, listen, it's not just about doing the right thing, it's about becoming the right person. And I think that there might be some people here, I mean, I don't know, who need to hear these two words today. Adultery and lust are very real issues. And for some of you, they might be the issue. Jesus wants to root this out in your life. He's saying, listen, man, on the other side of this, there's life. And there's life abundant, and there's fulfillment. You just have to trust that you're going to get there. Okay, so this is now where I wanted to land. This is like the more, potentially more problematic part of the passage. And this is where I think Jesus has some really practical advice for us. And not just about lust, not just about adultery, not just about anger, not just about murder, but about all of it. For a long time, these verses, and like I've done, are connected to the adultery piece. But what scholars believe and think is that actually this is Jesus summing up a good chunk of text. And preparing us for a good chunk more of text. Like, this is not just about lust. But he does. He says, listen, so if your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. We're going to deal with that part another time. If you have questions about that, just come and talk to me, okay? And if your right hand causes you to stumble, he says, cut it off. Throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. And so that, we look at it and we go, oh, surely not. Like that just seems a little bit extreme. But here's the practicalness of what Jesus is saying. He's saying this, that just like actions can reveal your heart, actions can also help heal your heart. So hear me. I'm not saying that you doing the right thing is going to fix everything. I'm saying that when we try to do the right thing, when we take practical steps forward, we position ourselves for God to heal what is broken in our lives. And so certain things that we do put us into positions for God not to be able to act and work and heal in immediate ways. And certain things that we do position ourselves to be open to God acting and healing in your life and in my life. And so what Jesus says is, listen, the things that you do, if you're committing adultery, chances are you have an issue with lust. If you commit murder, chances are that you have an issue with anger. If you flip people off when you're commuting on the 403, I've never done that. It's never gotten that bad, okay? I would tell you if it did. Chances are you have an issue with anger, right? Like the actions, the things that we do reveal our hearts. He says the things that you do can also position you to be healed by God. And so that's where when he says, cut the hand off, gouge the eyeball out, like that's where it becomes really practical. Because again, for you, the issue might be adultery. The best thing for you not to do, like don't go and download Tinder on your phone. Tinder's a dating app, like a hookup dating app, for those of you who, you know, anyways, listen. Okay, don't put yourself in certain situations where you're gonna be tempted. If you look at websites after 10 o'clock that you probably shouldn't be looking at, and that happens on your phone or on a tablet or on a computer, you gotta shut that stuff down. You gotta leave your phone somewhere else. Don't take it into your bedroom. Turn your Wi-Fi off like at 10 o'clock. There are certain practical steps that you can take to avoid the things that tempt you. If you have a propensity to drink when you are stressed, right? When work is not going well, when your marriage is not going well, when your relationships are all falling apart around you and you're not quite sure what to do, the best thing you can do is, man, I'm just gonna numb the pain. I'm just gonna drink. I'm gonna drink a little bit too much, and that's gonna make me feel better. Don't keep alcohol in your house, right? Create barriers, create extra steps. Like if you need to get in the car and go to the grocery store and buy a bottle of wine to take it home to drink, chances are you are not going to go through all of those steps immediately every single time you're tempted. There's a statistic that I'm fascinated by. Fascinated is maybe not a good word once you hear the statistic, but they're in a book that I recently finished. They talked about how if somebody wants to take their own life, if somebody's contemplating suicide, that is linked to a time and a place. And so, for example, the example that they use is the Golden Gate Bridge. The people jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, California raised a bunch of money to put nets underneath. And you're like, simple solution, but people opposed it. People opposed it because they said, well, somebody who wants to commit suicide is just gonna find another way to do it. But you know what happened? When they put the nets down, like the number of suicides plummeted dramatically. Same thing with gas in England. There was a certain type of gas used to, like in your stove, in your cooking stove, and so there was a season where people would take their own life by putting their head in the stove and turning it on. Well, they swapped out the gas, and the suicide number plummeted because they noticed that it was connected to a method, a time, a place, and if you took that away, the chances that that person would take their life was very, very slim. They did not find other ways. And so here's the thing for you, is that there is something that you are tempted by. There is something that you will tip toward. There is something that you will lean on in those seasons of life that is unhealthy. And if you put up a barrier to that, the chances of you finding something else is actually pretty slim. The chances of you being able to take a step forward is pretty high because you've cut off, you've made it harder for you to take that step, for you to turn to that sin or vice or whatever you find yourself tipping toward or turning to. And so in that light, Jesus' advice becomes, in my estimation, actually really brilliant. Because he says, listen, there are just some practical things that you can do in order to let God get at your heart. The more time you spend doing those things, the less time you are giving for God to heal you. The more time you lean into what God wants for you, the more time you're allowing God to work on your heart. And so the challenge to us becomes, listen, because if you find, so, I mean, let's take lust, let's take that, let's take drinking, it can seem really daunting or difficult to get from where you are to where you know you need to be. Like, that gap could be very, very big. In fact, so big that it's just too, it's not even worth trying. What Jesus says is, listen, it's not your responsibility to heal yourself. It's not your responsibility to get from here to there. It's your responsibility to take one step. And it's God's to figure out the rest. And then eventually it'll be your responsibility to take another step. And then another step. Like, that's how God works. And for sure, are there moments where we see God, in one split second, complete, drinking, gone in a second? Yeah, that happens. But chances are it's a lot of little steps to get there first, right? Chances are it's a lot of little pieces of obedience. And so it's brilliant because it's completely doable. And here's the bigger problem, I think, for us, the bigger obstacle that each one of us needs to face in our lives, and maybe you need to face this. I did a little social experiment with my daughter. My daughter's 2. I probably shouldn't be admitting to things like this. We're recording this, right? Brilliant. So I did a social experiment on my daughter. How many of you buy mini eggs, Cadbury mini eggs, at Easter time? Yes, please. Okay, I used to buy the biggest bags. They would come. They'd be resealable with Ziploc sealers. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Cadbury figured out that they had a corner on something delicious, and they hiked those prices up. Woo! They're expensive, but... every Easter now, I buy myself a bag. It's about this big. I had it here. I gave it all away to the kids who are here. So it's about this big. I buy one for me, and I buy one for Connie, because we do not share our Cadbury eggs with each other. That's a different issue altogether. And I did this experiment with my daughter. I gave her one egg, because she came up. She saw me opening them, and she said, come up, Kaki? That's her way of saying chocolate. And so I said, absolutely, I'll give you a piece of chocolate. And so I gave her one piece of chocolate. And she looks at it, and she says, gaga daddy, which is thank you, gaga daddy. And not knowing, I had my hand closed in the other hand. And I said to Anna, Anna, you know who really loves these chocolates? I said, your mummy really loves these chocolates. I said, why don't you go give this chocolate that I just gave you to your mom? She really loves it. So she looks at this little piece of chocolate, this chocolate egg, and she looks at me, and she looks at her mom, and then she looks at the chocolate, and then she looks at her mom, and then she looks at the chocolate, and then she walked over to Connie and gave her the chocolate. She's like, gai gai, mommy. She also says that as a, you should say thank you to me now, mommy. She gave it to her mom, and she walked back over to me, and I kind of got down. I said, Anna, that was amazing. I said, I'm so proud of you. And I said, here, you can have these 2 chocolates. And so she got 2 out of the mix. I'm sure she got 20 from me over the course of the next little while, but it was just amazing to see her little mind at work, and then her choice to surrender the only piece of chocolate that she had for something that she didn't know was going to happen. And I feel like sometimes we're the little kid holding onto that piece of chocolate, only the chocolate is the alcohol or the anger or the rage or the adultery or whatever. And God's there saying, you just got to let it go. You have no idea what's on the other side. And we're the kid who looks at it, and we look at God, and we look back at it, and we look at God, and we look back at it, and we eat it. Because I want what I know I can have. And I want what I know I can have now. And I want what I have control over. And I want what I think I have control over. And I want what I think leads to life. And I want what's going to make me feel better now. And at the root of that is actually because we don't trust that God's a good father on the other side holding on to too many eggs. We think, man, like God's tricking us. Like there's nothing in his hand. In fact, one of the kids was like, I thought you were going to open up your hand and there'd be nothing. Like that's what we think of God. We think God's this like dude who just wants to coerce us to obey because he gets something out of it. We think that God's just trying to make us all, you know, obedient little whatever because that's, you know, what he wants to do with the world and his little type of manipulation. Like, if we believe in God at all. And we don't trust that God's going to say, listen, what I have for you is so much better. What I have for you on the other side is so much more abundant than what you feel you're stuck in or what you think you are stuck in or what you think you need now. You just have to trust that he's going to open up his hand and there's going to be something there. The real reason I think that you and I struggle with lust and adultery and anger and murder is actually for a reason that psychologists call secondary gains. Secondary gains are when we stay inside of dysfunction because what we're getting inside the dysfunction is good enough. It's not worth the pain of getting to the other side. It's not worth the trust of getting to the other side. It's not worth the obedience and getting to the other side because this is good enough. If I live inside my dysfunction, I get attention and that makes me feel good. And so, you know, listen, that's good enough. Right? We live inside of worlds that we make good enough and God says, man, you've got no idea what's on the other side. All you have to do is trust. So I'm going to pray. And if you have questions, I would love to have conversations with you afterward or some point during the week. Because things like this aren't typically... Things like this aren't typically things that we like admitting. Conversations like this aren't typical conversations that we're used to having inside the church. And yet God says, man, you've got no idea what I have for you. Let me pray. God, thanks that you're in this with us, and your desire isn't to like guilt and shame us. Whenever we feel that guilt and that shame, like, man, it might motivate us to a certain extent, but actually... you say, I've got life for you. I've got life abundant for you. There is forgiveness and grace and love that we long to know. We see it all over the place. Like, it's why we end up in dysfunctional relationships, because it's better than being alone. It's why we end up turning to things, coping mechanisms, alcohol, because it feels good enough. Why maybe even, you know, for some people, they turn to things like adultery. It's just easier. It feels good. And the marriage is too hard. God, you don't call us into what's easy, but you do call us into what is life-giving. And for so many of us, we know this simple truth that, man, some of the things that have been the most life-giving have taken the most work. Have been the hardest things. So God, would you show up, and for my friends here, if they're dealing with something, I pray that you would just remind them how much they're loved. That they don't have to change before you accept them. They don't have to change before they can belong. Like, this is not a community of perfect people. None of us. I'm not perfect. Nobody here. God, we're all trying to figure this out together. So, man, I'm just grateful that you're in this with us. I'm grateful, Jesus, that you died and came back to life so that we could know the fullness of life. And my heart, our heart together would be that everybody here would know and experience that. So, man, would you do what only you can do? And would you meet us in the midst of whatever it is we're going through?